Welcome, everyone, to a Baseball America podcast. Along with J.J. Cooper, I'm John Manuel. I want to remind you that Baseball America's 2015 books are now on sale. The 2014 books have been marked down, but the 2015 books, where it's book season right now with the regular season over, the Almanac, the Prospect Handbook, the 2015 Directory, the Super Register, even the Great Parks Calendar, which you're voting on, our Battle of the Ballparks on Facebook, all available at baseballamerica.com/store, J.J.
Fantasy Guy coming, too.
Fantasy Guy. I don't even think of that as a book.
It's a magazine.
It's a magazine. But, I mean, we've got our annual Hall of Fame encyclopedia that we do with the Hall of Fame now. This year's will have six new entries in it.
Hey!
Pretty good reason to get the book this year if you want to, if you're a Hall of Fame devotee or like the history of the game. If you're like the president of the game, this is a great time for you because the playoffs are upon us. And, J.J., I think one thing that I want to get this out of the way, I will say, first of all, I think we both love the playoff format. Second of all, I almost forgot this as part of my intro. I want to thank Lee Folger for his 15 years at Baseball America. We're on a new kind of era at Baseball America. Will Lingo already has been named the general manager of Baseball America, and which means it's the same as our old publisher title. It's kind of funny because Will is actually applying this morning for the job, which he's already been promoted to.
I hope that it works out for him.
Cause, yeah. he put me down as a reference this morning. He asked me. So.
Does that mean, is your title going to become assistant GM, or are you a special assistant to the GM? Or you know?
That's a good question. I hadn't asked. My title stays the same, domestic dad nerd. That hasn't changed. But I did want to just thank Lee for all the time that he's been at BA. Obviously, he's never been on this podcast. Thank God we would have had to shut down.
Yeah,
our bad joke quota would have been pegged.
If you're a listener who goes to winter meetings, you've heard the Lee Folger comedy experience. But
Lee's a good man, and yes. Worked with him for 15 years. And you know, that's a significant change here to have the person in charge of the company no longer in charge of the company, going to go work for the Durham Bulls as they promote the ACC baseball tournament. But you know, now we have a member of the editorial staff for the last 20 years in Will Lingo going to run the whole company. And so that's really a pretty special thing, and for somebody who's shared an office with Will for more than 9 years. I'm excited about it. I don't think people at home will notice any changes in Baseball America for the worse. I think we're going to see changes for the better. Because somebody who knows the product that intimately, somebody who used to do our Indie Ball notebook, is making the business decisions now. And I'm not casting any aspersions on Lee. I just have complete faith in Will. So I think it's going to be a really good period going forward. So, but I did want to say that I think it's a very unique situation in the publishing industry to have an editorial person being in charge of all those things. And Will used to be on the podcast, and he probably won't be on a podcast ever again. But the first podcast was me and Will at your church in 2006. And I was like, hey, wait a minute, I can walk around with these microphones. So I just started pacing around, and it was supposed to be 15 minutes. And shockingly, I went like 25. So good times. That's been 8 years plus of podcasts.
Again, a little trivia question. I'm saying it. We did figure out that LaTroy Hawkins, there is at least still a player who is technically at least active. We don't know if LaTroy will be back in 2015.
Wasn't a big farewell tour for LaTroy, so we don't know. Jason Giambi, I think, is another long-term player. I believe he was drafted in 1991 out of Long Beach State.
So there are still a few players left who were drafted. I mean, really, that's all we're talking about at this point, who were drafted before the Will Lingo Baseball America era began. But we're running out of those players very quickly.
It's pretty few for me. I mean, 96. I started September of 96. So that 96 draft, the Chris Bensons and the Braden Loopers and the Travis Lees and the...
They've been long gone.
Todd Helton, that was a 95 draft, if memory serves. So, yeah, most of the... I don't think, I mean, like even Kotze was 96 draft, he gone. So, yeah, been here a long time. In that time, when we started, we did start with three divisions. So we've had, if you really think about it, this quote-unquote new playoff format. I know we have the two wild cards, that's fairly new. But three divisions wild cards, which was 20 years ago, was like a seismic change in baseball. Not so seismic anymore. And JJ, I think we both agree that going to two wild cards, kind of almost wish this had been the format all along. It's a better format, even if you do have an imperfect one game. It's imperfect in fairness, but it's perfect for excitement. And we have two, I think, great wild card matchups.
I argue it's not imperfect at all. I think it is the perfect way to do it. I don't want to see a best of five wild card series to get us to the division series.
Completely agree.
No desire at all to see that, but I have every bit of the desire to see that you get rewarded. I know it's not completely fair. It's not a completely balanced schedule. It's something where, yes, a team with 88 wins could win a division while a team of 92 goes to the wild card.
Right.
All that. That's just sports. That's just the reality of it is that's the format in pretty much every game that we see played.
Right. That's life. You know, sometimes you wake up, you had a bad night's sleep, but you got to test the next morning. I mean, it's just everything's not optimal.
But I did not like the old format where, yep, really the 162 game season, there wasn't that much reward.
Being home field place advantage, was, yeah.
Home field advantage for a series is not enough reward for congratulations, you were better over the course of 162.
Right.
Getting in saying you are in the division series, and by the way, these other two teams are playing a one game do or die for the right to get to the division series.
Right.
That is absolutely, to me, the perfect reward for valuing the 162 game season and consistency over such a long stretch.
Here's a crazy idea I just am actually thinking of. I mean, like, there are always these ideas of, I agree that the current format is, if you're going to have expanded playoffs, not just going to have National League winner goes to World Series, American League winner goes to World, which is not realistic anymore. But if you're going to do it the way I think this is the best format. I do have a crazy, it just popped in my head, because, you know, Scott Boras has had some ideas, and one thing I really respect about Scott is that he sees the game somewhat like we do. Actually, he has better perspective because he's more intimately involved. He knows more about it. But he sees the game from the amateur perspective. He's invested in that with high school tournaments. He spent, obviously, the time that he spends recruiting amateur players. And then, obviously, he's invested at the big league level. He's not the only person, but he's the one who's gotten publicity for this idea of having, like, the World Series be 9 games and having the first 2 games being in a neutral site. Would these wild card games be games that you could have at a neutral site that would be interesting? Would you be interested if just you had a one-day doubleheader, you go to a dome stadium, whether it's in Arizona or whatever, and the American League wild card is the at matinee and the National League wild card is the night game, or vice versa, you flip it like that? Would you have any interest in that?
No.
Okay.
And here's why I say that. This, I mean, there's also a reward right now for being the first wild card,
right,
compared to the second. If you were, last year, if you were a Pittsburgh Pirates fan,
right,
and they said, hey, congratulations, you're the number one wild card, and you get to bat in the bottom of the ninth,
right,
in Arizona. If I was a Pirates fan, I would feel entirely and totally cheated.
Here's your reward. Here's a $1,000 plane ticket,
right,
to, you know, and you're plane not, and hotel to go to Arizona.
Right. To me, that does not, and to me, this is something where baseball, I know we have cold weather, we're going to be right to the bumping up against November, all that.
Right.
That being said, because baseball is not a one game, do it, you know, yeah, like here we all just meet, play one game and go home, it needs to be in the home parks.
I mean, I agree.
You know,
I do think that's the one day you could maybe do something. I don't think you do that with the World Series.
Yeah, I think.
But I think it'll be, it could get interesting if you had a wild card day and just had one day and you had a 1 o'clock game and a 6 o'clock game, and that would be interesting. That would be a fun day where it's four teams enter, two teams leave. You know, that could be fun.
Hey, again, I love the wild card being this way because one game winner, you know, goes on is fascinating baseball. It leads to different strategies, some of which are fun, some of which are, get a little tiresome, to be honest.
Yes.
But the biggest thing, though, is that I know we have a lot of traditionalists who think, you know, like, well, you know, we've cheapened it. It was the best when it was that everyone battled. And admittedly, there are a lot less teams then.
Right.
But you're the National League winner. Congratulations. You're the American League. There's actually, the thing about it is in many ways, I think that if we did have that, which, again, I think there are people out there who still wish we did that, it's a disaster.
Yeah.
It basically means, we talk about the sanctity of the 162-game season and how it's important and all. What you would have when you have a dominant team is that pretty much come the start of August, it'd be like, okay, we now give permission to everyone pretty much who's a casual fan, check out for the rest of the year.
Exactly. Could you imagine, like, I mean, this is a long time ago, but like the 84 Tigers, when they started off, what was it, 35-5 or something like that? Everyone in the American League East basically did check out that year because the Tigers dominated so much. I mean, I know there have been dominant teams since then. That's still the first one. I mean, the Yankees, 98 Yankees. I mean, there was no interest in that division race. The interest was in them chasing the all-time wins record. But, I mean, yeah, like you said, this is a better system. I agree.
This right now.
You have 30 teams. You have nearly twice the number of teams. Maybe 10 teams in the grand scheme of team things seems like it's too many playoff teams. I think it's actually just right.
I don't think we've ever had a team. I know that we now have teams who win, 85, 86, 87 can now get in sometimes. But it doesn't happen very often.
Right.
And the thing about it is you still... We've yet to have a sub-500 team. We came close.
Right.
But if I remember correctly, we have not had a sub-500
team. No, the Padres were, 82 and 79 or 82 and 80 that year? 2005, I think it was.
But over the course, again, baseball has a schedule unlike any other schedule in sports. I don't think there's – I mean, it's not close. 162 games, we do have essentially a reward for that.
I think there is an – And you have these two cities with this very 1979 feeling playoffs with the Angels. That's why I say specifically 79, but a 70s feel. A's, Royals, Pirates, Orioles, Angels. These are all teams that the Angels had that obviously had your Nolan Ryan and your 1979 team. You had the Orioles and the Pirates squared off in two World Series to bookend that decade, 71 and 79. But for the Royals and Pirates, the Pirates were the feel good story last year. Now the Royals kind of are this year, JJ. They're your two wild card home teams. You've done our Royals prospect list for a long time. You know Royals fans' angst. I mean, I guess it is irony that the Royals are the least statistically analysis, analytics, moneyball kind of team you could almost think of when they are really the birthplace of it, considering Bill James and the revolution that he begat. I have always thought that's ironic, and yet this Royals team, despite having one of the weakest, the fewest home runs for a playoff team since the 88 Dodgers, and they certainly don't have Oral Hershiser on the mound, although James Shields is a good pitcher. But there's no single...
If he does an Oral Hershiser, 88, then we will truly, he will be big game James forever.
But I mean, they are not a playbook that most teams can execute to get to the playoffs. Their margin for error is so slim. And yet they're here, and they're playing an A's team that was 15-30 at one stretch down the stretch of the season, and a great former AL East matchup with Lester, the ex-Red Sox, and Shields, the ex-Ray. This is a really compelling wild card in the American League, and I love Matt Meyer's tweet about it. Once and for all, Moneyball will be settled. Billy Beane's A's against Art Stewart's Royals.
The funny thing is that I hear where you're coming from, and some ways they are the anti-Moneyball. I mean, especially if we reduce Moneyball back to 2002, walks good. This is a Royals team that, when it comes to walks, they have not seen a ball in a 3-1 count.
It's just not an emphasis. It's not an emphasis. But, there is a different mindset, in these organizations.
But I would say, the funny thing is in a different way, and you can call it sabermetric or not, what I find fascinating about the Royals is that the Royals actually have done some things some other ways that actually are kind of analytical. And maybe they came across it. I don't know if they came across it on purpose or not. But the big trend a couple of years ago everyone was talking about was defense and how important defense was.
Well, right.
Especially with their park. Their park is one that knocks down home runs. That's not the reason they haven't hit any home runs, because they haven't hit any home runs at home. They haven't hit any home runs on the road.
Right.
But their park is not one for home runs. What they did is they have, I think it's pretty simply the best defense out there. As far as, they have an outfield defense that is insane, because
dynamic, athletic defense in the outfield especially. And then really, the left side of their infield is pretty tremendous.
So with that, what it's allowed them to do, I mean, Jeremy Guthrie, Jason Vargas, they're not exceptional pitchers by any stretch of imagination.
Right.
But you put them, especially you got some guys with fly ball tendencies, you put them in that ballpark, you put them with an outfield that runs down, turns doubles into outs, you do that. And then one other thing they do, they don't hit home runs, but they steal bases at an extremely high rate for modern day baseball. They led baseball. I know they led the AL in steals. And they did it while stealing at a very high success rate, which is something, it's one thing to go out there and steal bases, but if you're stealing that, and you're getting thrown out one out of every three times, you're not doing anything for you.
And like we talked about, their offense right now, their best case offensive scenario, JJ, is Get someone on, keep it close, get someone on late, and let's hope it's Dyson, and or we go to Gore. I mean, like, they're one of their biggest weapons.
Dyson,
is
Gore, and pray for
like
more.
Mini Billy Hamilton, basically, and Terrence Gore. One of the guys that we got to see in that 2012 Appy League playoff series.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite games of all time, 2012 Appy League, Elizabethton and Burlington. And Terrence Gore was there, and here 2 years later, he's playing in the playoffs. I mean, it's pretty awesome that he's playing.
There, if you are, I think every Royals fan out there right now, we're recording this at 10:50 in the morning on the morning of these games. If you told every Royals fan, hey, it's going to be a tie score at the end of the sixth inning, whatever that score is, and I think most Royals fans would kind of think it would be 1-1, you know. But if it's a tie score at the end of the sixth inning, every Royals fan in the country would probably sign up for that. Because, no, their best offense in many ways is someone walks or someone gets hit by a pitch or someone lines a single. Because they are actually a team that puts the ball in play.
Right.
But someone gets a single and then it is, okay, Dyson, you come in. And, yes, it doesn't – when you have guys who really are, you know, top-of-the-scale speed guys who know how to steal bases, there's not a lot, especially a lot of relievers, there's not a lot they can do.
Right, right.
Again, if you're 1-3 of the plate,
yep,
and that's who you are, and a lot of relievers, you know, often are because they don't have to worry about this that often.
Right.
But if you're that kind of guy, yes, you can call the pitch out, but then you are shifting the advantage to the hitter because let's say you call a pitch out and nothing happened. Okay, well, you just gave him a ball. And then after that, you can't call a second one usually.
Right, exactly.
So then Dyson or
Gore. It's the one pitch you never double up on.
So then Gore or Dyson is going to be standing on second. And again, the other thing in this game, you know, the A's have the interesting question of, so who do you start at catcher?
Right. It's a challenge for Oakland. I mean, what do you do back there? Do you start Derek Norris? Do you start, I mean, they obviously had concussion issues for John Jaso, which I think were underplayed as far as like his absence and the effect that had on their lineup. But the A's are a fascinating team, as are the Royals. JJ, I mean, like, so much of the attention went to the Cespedes trade with Oakland. At first, I was of the mind that when Oakland first slumped after that trade, that it was just some regression, natural regression, and that's why Oakland struggled so much after he left. It got so bad, I started to think, wow, maybe they really do miss him. I think it's probably both. And there was some regression, but they certainly missed having that threat in their lineup, I thought.
I agree somewhat, but I do think more than that, it is that, I mean, I think the funny thing is I think this is some of the reasons that Billy Bean made those trades, is because I think if you looked at this team at the midpoint of the season and looked at them with a skeptical eye, you could say, and they said it, and there was some of this evaluation at the time, you know what, this team as it is constructed right now is probably not nearly as good as this record indicates.
Right.
Like, Scott Kazmir is not going to be this Scott Kazmir for an entire 162-game season. And Jesse Chavez ended up still a very good year, but Jesse Chavez was not as good over the second half. And it's not something where you can say, well, we couldn't have seen that coming. Jesse Chavez had never been that good.
Right.
Scott Kazmir was essentially a year and a half out of the Sugarland Skeeters in Indie Ball, where he had a worse ERA than he had this year in the AL.
Right, but he was pretty good for Cleveland last
year.
I mean, obviously,
was.
I mean, I don't think they were expecting him to regress. I think they were not expecting their offense to take as big of a step back. But that offense, I do think, obviously, Cespedes being out of it's part of it. Brandon Moss's hip injury, I think, is a big part of it.
Yeah.
It really seemed like it just that combination kind of left Josh Donaldson on an island. You know, Coco Crisp hasn't been as good in the second half as he was in the first. I don't know. I mean, I guess I wonder which team you really think was closer to the real. I mean, I don't think Oakland's a 15 games under 500 team like they were in the second half. But I don't think they were the best team in baseball as they were in the first half either. I mean,
I think when this all settles out, I think they ended up being about the team that they actually are.
But going forward, they're in. Are they? The trades were made adding Lester and Samardzija so that Billy's stuff would work in the postseason, because he famously said it didn't in the past. Do you think they're better constructed for the playoffs now once it's all said and done?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, I mean, you're saying that, okay, take, you know, Cespedes is out. Okay, so we're losing him. But then add in that you're really your number one and number two starters in the playoffs are Lester and Samardzija. Let's take him out. Okay, let's say that they made it in the same situation without that trade. You know, and again, you So you give him some margin in this situation.
Yeah, the luxury is almost having some margin as your three, because Sonny Gray.
Yeah, you can. I mean, you really though you've got two. You've got a one, and then you've got you really have three guys.
Yeah, you have three guys who you feel comfortable starting at the front of the playoff rotation.
The Angels, who won a gazillion games, are looking at that. Go, wait, you can have three of these guys?
Wait, Jesse Chavez will be our two. That's what they're looking at.
No,
seriously.
I mean, Jason Hamill would be starting in the postseason for them, would he not?
Oh, no doubt. He'd be there, too. He'd be their number two. I mean, C.J. Wilson had a terrible stretch. Shoemaker's banged up. I mean, the Angels are a very unique
team. Can you remember? I cannot remember a team where they're going to have to count on a guy in the playoffs who didn't even get to have any reacclimation process.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the last team that had a postseason rotation in the shape that the Angels are. Not just any team. The team that had the best record in the major leagues. Team that won 98 games.
And the funny thing about it is that I actually think in some ways, and I don't know if Mike Socha's got to do this, but we've talked about it's not necessarily a fun brand of baseball to watch, but I do think in the playoffs, because of the off days that you have, I mean, the schedule is such that you can tax your bullpen pretty regularly, and especially, I hate to say this, but especially if you're the Angels case. I mean, this is 2014 and 15 to extent or bust. I mean, because we are in France and it's, 1785 and you go, huh, they're seeming kind of restless out. It's going to get bad. Après le mois, le déluge. I mean, so it's coming bad.
I just assumed that you're getting ready. You're going to say 1917 or 1918. Yeah. Like, this needs to end now.
But no, but
you went even further on that.
My ancient French Revolution history.
I thought we were going to get a Marshall Foch reference. But we've talked about him lately too.
But they are going for it. If you have to, I know another way to put it. You do not worry that you say, "Wow, we really overworked that reliever a little bit, and it's going to really come back and hurt us in 2015."
Correct.
You, with what they're going to do, you are going to go to that pen. If Weaver's not on the mound, that call's coming quick.
Jared Weaver probably has more pressure on him than any starting pitcher in this postseason. He's so far and away the ace of that team. He's been around there a long time. If he doesn't pitch deep in a game and they don't win games that he starts, I have a feeling the Angels feel like they're in trouble.
But the thing about it is their bullpen is good enough.
Oh, it's very good now.
So what I'm saying is that I think in some ways, the fact that it could be Corey Rasmus starting a game is actually an advantage because you don't have any qualms if Corey Rasmus has a good first and a pretty good second, and he runs into trouble in the third, you're like, okay, let's bring in the lefty, then the righty, then the lefty, then the righty.
And let's face it, the Angels championship in 2002, they had decent starting pitching at that time, but that was famously a bullpen, Brandon Donnelly. Who was the other guy with the crazy goggles? Wise, was that it? No, because I don't even know if they had Scott Shields, but they had
Scott Shields and then K-Ro. I mean, obviously
they had two ex-Indy ballers setting up. I forget one guy who had Ben Weber, the hand pump. They had Weber, they had Donnelly, then they had K-Rod, and then, of course, they still had Troy Percival. Mm-hmm. So they really had like a four. So in the last game of that March of attrition, John Lackey gives you five innings. Rookie John Lackey gives you five in Game 7. They could get you through the last four. So it's not like Mike Socha hasn't done this before. He has. It was a long time ago. The game has changed.
But my point being, you don't worry. With Corey Rasmus, you're pulling him at the first sign of trouble. Whereas if you had essentially, if this was in Shoemaker now, because of the injury, you're not worrying about doing that. But if it was something where you had a guy who is not really going to give you that much more chance to win, but he's, quote, the established veteran, it's tougher to pull C.J. Wilson from that game.
I agree. If you have a short outing from Wilson or Weaver, it's one thing. That could be one that does affect your team. But if you have if you get four outings that are Corey Rasmus, if he has to start in the postseason, you're feeling pretty good if you're an Angels player. Hey, we're going to our bullpen. That's our strength.
But again, now let's just throw this out there. Like, okay, here is the guys that they could go to. You're saying, okay, so Houston Street, Joe Smith. Again, I think all these guys are healthy if I remember right now. To be honest, I haven't watched a whole lot of Angels games recently because they won that division a while back. But, Jepsen, Morin, Salas, Grilly, they have. I mean, I don't know how, you know, they haven't had to set a roster yet, but they have 6 to 7 legit bullpen arms.
Yeah, the last time I saw Michael Morin pitch was he's getting beat back-to-back nights by St. John's in the 2012 regional in Chapel Hill, getting beat by St. John's. And now, just 2 years later,
60 quality inning, 60 quality outings.
Yeah, he was outstanding this year. Really, really, very solid former number one prospect in the Mink League. So, our summer college league prospect list, which are up on the site right now.
But my point
read
being,
them. You might have a future Michael Morin in there.
But my point being, they are not going to have. I mean, with their situation, if you carry, and I would say if I'm them, I'm carrying 7 ideal. I mean, they're a team that I can see why.
Correct.
You can turn to them every single night.
They really are.
Games will take 5 hours. But
it could be a really almost thought-provoking to watch if the Angels win. This is it's a pitching year. It seems like we're in a pitching era, a strikeout era, a depressed offense era, and yet the Angels led the American League in runs scored, and they may have led the major leagues. This is a devastating offense in today's context. They have the best player in baseball. I mean, the storyline you could see if the Angels win it is Derek Jeter retires.
You the crown.
Exactly, and hands the baton of baseball off to Mike Trout, who certainly is well known. I mean, he's the only active baseball player I know other than Jeter who's doing national TV commercials. Mm. It's pretty much Trout. Who else does them?
Joe
Mauer still doing any Head and Shoulders commercials?
I was going to say, don't CJ Wilson?
He does Head and Shoulders as well. But Trout, to me, you know, we had this whole face
Harper.
Of baseball.
Bryce
yeah, that's right, the Gatorade, you're right. So this is the chance. It would be awesome for the sport, in my mind, just looking at it from a big picture. If you had a Washington and Angels World Series, and it was Harper Trout, even though Harper's certainly not the main player in Washington. And I'm also going to point out one quick diversion, as we mentioned the Nationals, JJ. Remember how we, even in the office, like, how could Jim Callis write Anthony Rendon better than Bryce Harper? Yeah, Anthony Rendon was better than Bryce Harper this year. Anthony Rendon is probably probably the Nationals' best position player. He's just a stud of a player. Adam Kilgore of the Washington Post had a great feature on Anthony Rendon the other day. And so this is, we just had, I mean, there's a lot of fatigue, a lot of Jeter fatigue. I don't know how yet. I guess I understood it before the last weekend. The last weekend was pretty phenomenal with his last game in Yankee Stadium and then the ceremony the Red Sox did. I think now that it's over, I think people almost might miss it a little bit because it was so well done at the end. But so Jeter exits stage left. We have a chance to have baseball's two biggest young stars in Trout and Harper, biggest names among his young stars, take center stage. And that, to me, as someone who is interested in capital B baseball as an industry and how it's doing, I'm excited for that. And it would also be fascinating to watch in a year of bullpens and bullpen relief pitchers striking guys out, throwing as hard as they can, for the Angels basically with one cromulent starting pitcher to win a World Series or to go deep in a postseason with the kind of bullpen approach you're talking about. That would be emblematic of the times.
That's the digression I want to go on, is that I think that this playoffs and what happened at the end of the season is very important for baseball, and I think it's in a way that we may end up having to have some sort of rule adjustment to keep us, to essentially save the game from the direction it's going, in that I think what we saw with the Angels, what fascinated me is that when Garrett Richards went down, the Angels were still at that point. It's hard to believe now, but if you were think back all the way back to a month ago, they were still in a playoff at a pennant race.
Yeah, they only had like a 1 or 2 game lead.
It was
on
not
the A's,
something where the A's had faded out of the picture. It was, hey, we're heading down, and they had a situation where they literally had no starting pitching option on their team where you could say, okay, well, next guy up. They didn't have it. So their choices were one of two.
Their option was Wade LeBlanc.
Right. And so they didn't have it. And so their choices were, we either go out and get a starting pitcher, you know, at that point they are really checking the cushions of the couch to see, do we have a prospect left who could get us, you know.
I would love to have been on those phone calls to Salt Lake. So who are your starting pitchers? Who's most ready? Well,
but
call AA.
So they had a choice of doing that to get a starting pitcher in, or doing what they did, which is, we're just not going to have a starting pitcher for those days. That will be, it is Sunday in college baseball, where it is Johnny Holstaff, and that's what we're going to do. And the thing about it is they not only did it, It succeeded. And then you saw
they ran away from the division.
And then you saw the Mariners.
Right.
At the end of the season. Now, their point, they had, their option was is either they could call up a guy from AAA, and they had some options there. Or, but when Chris Young basically said, oh, he's done, their choices, when they were still in it, was let's start Tom Wilhelmsen, and we're going to go Johnny Holstaff, and we'll try to win that way. The thing about it is which is interesting, but also I think in some ways frightening for baseball, is teams are realizing more and more that it is easier to find seven guys for your bullpen who can have success,
right,
than it is to find a fourth or fifth guy for your... If you have a fourth or fifth guy in your rotation go down, and especially when we get to September, when it's like, we got 13 guys in our bullpen.
It's like running back, because the analogy I make, you're the big football guy, but isn't this the way major NFL teams have evolved on running backs? Would you rather pay one guy... I understand you have to have five starting pitchers, so it's different. Would you rather have one guy who you're going to give the ball 25 times to, you're going to wear him out, but you're probably going to have to pay him a decent amount of money to be that one guy... Or would you rather have three guys? And they just specialization wins out.
But let's go a step further, though, because when it comes to starting pitchers to relief pitchers, what we've seen, and we have so many examples right now, but we've got some huge examples this year. Okay, look at the Yankees. Dellin Betances,
right.
Failed starter.
Epically failed. Epically successful reliever.
Wade Davis. Wade Davis has had, at this point, enough starts to establish. Wade Davis, not a good starting pitcher. Wade Davis, one of the best years you'll ever see for a reliever. By the way, and he's following up Luke Hochaver, who had even more chances to show, I cannot start. And Luke Hochaver had an epically good season last year before blowing his elbow out. You look at the Orioles. They've done this. You look at team after team, and what you've found is...
Yeah, Zach Britton, failed Orioles starter. Andrew Miller, failed Red Sox starter. Failed everybody starter.
Tommy Hunter.
Yeah, exactly.
You look at player... Tommy Hunter as a starter is like, his stuff pretty vanilla.
Yeah.
Tommy Hunter is reliever. You're going, where's that velo coming from?
Yeah.
And we talk about it even in the minor leagues. I was talking to a manager who's like, yeah, we took one of our fifth starter here. We put him in the pen for a couple of games. He's like... Is he throwing 98?
Yeah. By the way, here are your AAA Salt Lake starters this year. Jared Grubb, 32. Wade LeBlanc, aforementioned Wade LeBlanc. Justin Thomas, 30. Anthony LaRue, and no, he still was kicking around with his 6.75 ERA. And Caleb Clay. And don't forget, Yoslan Herrera was down there kicking around. Chris Volstad and Randy Wolf.
So what
those are the guys who got starts.
So what we're saying, no.
This is why the Angels went to this bullpen approach. But, and like you said, JJ, it was effective for them. And it feels like this is becoming the template going forward.
What I'm saying is going forward, I think that more teams are going to say, you know, if you have an injury, a starter go down. Rather than, it's one thing, if you go out and get a Samard or a Lester, but is it really worth it to go out? Who was the soft tosser a few years ago, traded from the NL to the AL?
Left-hander or right-hander?
Left-hander.
Traded to which team?
I want to say the Red Sox had him 1 year, and he was just terrible for them. It's not worth it. My point is that we'll just leave this as part of this is the organicness of the podcast. But the point being though is that if you're trying to add a fifth starter type,
right,
is that really and you're gonna it's gonna cost you talent to go get that guy?
And that's what's so interesting is they had the A's and the Angels taking really these completely opposite approaches. The A's decided to win in the postseason. We're going to load up on starting pitching, on frontline starting pitching, dominant power arms, one of whom in Lester we're really banking on with this exalted postseason pedigree that he's earned from back to when he was recovering from cancer in 2007 as a rookie with the Red Sox to what he did in 2013 with the Red Sox. So this is a guy with two World Series rings, was a key part of both teams, especially last year. They're banking on that. Along with Samardzija and Gray, and the Angels are pretty much banking on this Johnny Holstaff approach. And the National League really is different too, JJ, in that you have, to me, three of the better starting rotations in all of baseball. The Nationals, to me, probably the best.
Yeah, I think that's
where Tanner Roark has a tremendous year.
Congratulations.
I still think he's turning into a pumpkin at some point, but God, the guy had an amazing season. I probably should give him his due. But he's like their fifth starter. And their debate is over who's our number one. Is it Pfister or is it Zimmerman who just threw the no-hitter?
Or
is it Strasburg who has the best stuff maybe on the planet? I think they're settling on Strasburg. But
the great thing for them is they don't have to have an answer to that.
Right.
It's they don't next have guy up.
Exactly. And then you have in the other series, you have Cardinals-Dodgers. And the first game there is just Wainwright versus Kershaw. I mean, you know,
and by the way, and we got Greinke sitting in, you know, waiting in the wings.
And the Cardinals have Lance Lynn, who's another underrated starting pitcher, who just every year now just goes out and gets 180 to 200 innings and wins 15 to 18 games and is above average in just about every way. His walk rate, his strikeout rate, his durability. Lance Lynn's just really good, underrated and really good. So. You do have these dueling. Obviously, Detroit banking 100% on starting pitching, certainly not banking on its bullpen. And Baltimore, I think, is the opposite. Baltimore doesn't have an ace. I think their starting pitching is underrated. I think Chris Tillman's really good. I think Gonzalez is good. I like their starting pitching. Wei Yin Chen. But their bullpen's otherworldly. It's mostly failed starters. And then you have Buck Showalter, who knows how and when to deploy Darren O'Day. Knows how and when to deploy Tommy Hunter, O'Day, the one non-failed starter. And then it was mostly a ground ball pitching staff, and then you add in Andrew Miller to give you some swing and miss tendencies in that bullpen, and their bullpen's been unhittable. I do think Baltimore is the team that's probably going to be carried more by its pitching than you think, because I wonder...
They better, because their offense is...
Right. The Machado injury is still the one that sticks out the most to me. At first base, okay, they lose Chris Davis. Steve Pierce actually had a better year. I think they're better off with Steve Pierce. I don't know. There's no way you can argue they're better off at third base with the conglomeration of people they're playing there versus Manny Machado.
Because they don't really have an
They
answer.
Don't. It's like Ryan Flaherty. So they don't have to play Jonathan Scope, who at second base with his .210 batting average and 130 strikeouts and 10 walks. All values are approximate. But I think they're the team that's most affected by injuries. What's your take on Detroit, JJ? Is this team, are they closer to the Oakland? I mean, they feel like they're so similar to Oakland, and their regular season was almost a disappointment. But now that they're in, I have to like a team's chances with Scherzer. Verlander's been better down the stretch. Porcello, the way he's pitched. And obviously David Price, who was money for them in his last start.
No, I think they're a team that is, they're much more dangerous in the playoffs than they were in the regular season, largely because the worst part for them is that once Anibal Sanchez went down, they kind of floundered somewhat trying to figure out who's the next guy up.
Yeah, I mean, they gave key playoff post-September innings to Kyle Lobstein.
Right, and that's after going through Buck Farmer and you know, some others. Their bullpen is still, that's frightening.
They didn't have the bullpen arms to try to do
what
the
Angels did. No. That would have just been like, here's some kerosene,
exactly.
You know, enjoy. You know, I mean, they're the team for, you know, young manager, inexperienced, you say, okay, how's he going to have the postseason? They run the risk of being criticized the most because I understand in some ways why David Price might go longer in a game than he really should.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. They've done that a few times in September with starting pitchers. It almost always seemed like it backfired for them, but I understand why they did it.
Jeff Supon. That's who I was talking about.
Oh, yeah. Soft tosser. Had good years, even with the Cardinals as late as 2004.
Right, but he was...
Bad base running, good pitching.
But he was the guy who it was like, is it really worth bringing him into the AL East if... Again.
At that time, it was really not. Yeah, he got hammered. I do remember that. I was automatically thinking left-hander. So when you said soft tosser. Yeah, Detroit to me, Detroit-Baltimore series is kind of a fascinating series of those two. Who's your favorite in each league, JJ? American League, National League? Do you have a favorite?
I do think it's funny. I think it has to be the Nationals in the NL because I feel like that they're complete.
Yeah,
like,
I agree.
I feel like with the, you know, not that I think the Cardinals, you know, I want to talk. We haven't talked about the Pirates, and yeah. I don't want to give them. I'm sorry to give the Giants short shrift, but I do. I find the Pirates fascinating because it's funny. The Royals are understandably the story of hey, they made the playoffs.
Yeah.
You know, they ended their drought last year. That was a great story for the pitch. But to me, what the Pirates have done, massive credit to their front office, to Clint Hurdle, massive credit to everyone there because They have now, I know that they fell apart 2 years in a row.
Right.
In a gut-wrenching fashion if you're a Pirates fan. But they have been a quality team for half the season, then half the season, then a full season.
So it was half the season, a little longer the next year. Then they got over the hump last year. And then to sustain it is harder than to do it once.
And not only that, but the way they do it. I mean, they've been creative when they've had holes created. Josh Harrison, you know, ended up being the, hey, we can stick him wherever we need to, which is incredibly useful. And I don't think he should get MVP votes because to have a guy who produced like he did, but not only that, but if you need a second baseman, Neil Walker's okay, well, you know, if you need
Andrew
a third
McCutcheon?
Baseman.
How often is Andrew McCutcheon thrown at? How often has he been, how often, I feel like his injury of the, you know, the rib, what do you have, cracked rib, and he's played with it. The whole second half, he's been better. He's had a better year this year than he had last year. He doesn't have as much help in terms of that one big bag. Certainly their whole lineup feels like it's just significantly better. But last year they had Pedro Alvarez tied for the National League lead in home runs. So you had one other big threat. This year, it feels like the whole team's a threat. I think Jordy Mercer's their only starter, along with their right field conglomeration that's below average, league average OPS. But I think even Mercer's offensive production is above average for a shortstop.
Absolutely.
27 doubles, 12 home runs. So their offense is up, but McCutcheon's just been tremendous. I mean, he doesn't get talked about enough, it feels like, in the National League MVP race. And the other key, what, all the stuff you're talking about, JJ, is the case for the Pirates as organization of the year is very strong because it's a sustained. And this is a franchise. A couple years ago, we were kind of mocking them for the Hoka Hayes stuff and all the stuff they were doing in the instructional league. And it felt like they were trying to turn the corner and just couldn't. But they certainly have. And I think Clint Hurdle deserves credit for that. I think Neil Huntington deserves credit for that.
Absolutely.
And I think that the number one credit for that, to me, goes to Andrew McCutcheon. They have a star who they've built around, and he's taken that leadership role the way you're supposed to. Not so much vocally in the press, but just like playing through injury, raising his game when his team needs him. He's so much fun to watch as a star, a compelling star of a team. That's another guy who I hope, if Pittsburgh has a deep playoff run, that his profile nationally is raised.
That being said, the other thing I think you have to give massive credit there is Ray Searidge.
Yes, absolutely.
And,
so
and, Jim Benedict at the minor league level, because what they have done.
Yep,
it is
point.
It is to me the most impressive thing in many ways that they have done is that most difficult thing. Well, I don't want to say most difficult, but one of the most difficult things out there is to take the year after year they're taking pitching reclamation projects and they're figuring out, doesn't always work.
Yep.
But they've taken guy after guy. Edison Volquez is pitching the wild card game tomorrow.
Now this is
and it's not something where you go, wow. I mean, they're not doing it from the standpoint of, oh boy, this just did not work out for us.
This is the guy who like gave up the home run to Chris to your boy Colabello in the WBC for the Dominican last year, and like he was sort of the Dominican ace in the WBC. That's about the only time Edison Volquez has ever been a playoff ace.
Do you remember? I remember him in the playoffs with the Reds, where the Reds didn't have an ace, and so he threw him out there, and it's like, well, if everything goes right, he could shove for seven innings, but he also could be done in the first.
That's it. He
and
had
he was
his chance
more
to be
done
a playoff,
in the first.
That's it. He had his chance to be a playoff ace, and he completely whiffed on it. He's kind of always had ace stuff. I remember one of the years I did the Rangers prospect list, and he was in the Midwest League, and I had him 12th because scouts I talked to did not like the arm action, didn't see a breaking ball, fastball. I remember thinking, fastball, changeup, right-hander with a weird arm action. Sounds like a reliever. And I remember A.J. Preller, who had just gone to work for the Rangers, I believe, saying, you are so light on Volquez. I mean, I'm just telling you, that guy is a frontline starter. So, A.J., now your general manager in San Diego, correct. John Manuel, incorrect. So that's why he's one of the many reasons he's a GM. But I mean, he's been a tease for a long time. He's certainly had his moments. But Ray Searidge is a guy where I get texts from scouts who are like, yeah, I'll probably go to Pittsburgh and Ray Searidge will turn him into a stud. So like you said, Jim Benedict.
He's become another Cooper. I mean, he has.
And Jim Benedict was the guy who has started this blueprint for them on the amateur, on the player development side of pitching development, and look at the stride they've made there. I know Tyone got hurt, but Glasnow, Kingham, they've got prospects coming through. And Garrett Cole, I mean, that was a great, obviously, I mean, you're going to pick first overall in a draft. That was like, what, the last time that the Astros didn't pick first overall in the draft? So they made the right pick. Timing certainly helps. But the Nationals drafted first overall back-to-back years, Strasburg and Harper. Pirates, Garrett Cole. That timing is good.
But the other thing about it is that I also find interesting is that we now are seeing this year, we have the two small market teams who took the approach, which I think was a wise approach.
Yes.
That with the old draft system that said, you know what? Like, the Royals, if you rewind the clock back to 2000, the Royals were always cheap.
Where's your return on investment going to be, though?
Right.
Better for that.
But the Royals, if you went back to, like, 2003, 4, 5, what they would always do is...
Oh, even before that.
Yeah, but they would always go out. I'm saying even right before they changed it. It was like, yeah, we'll give 3 years to Jose Guillen.
Right.
Kyle Farnsworth, yeah, you know. I mean,
5 to Gilmesh.
You know, think... They did that. And what they did is they said, you know what? Is it, if we're going to spend $30 million over the next 3 years, would it be better to spend it on a second division to fringe first division outfielder
right.
at the big league level?
And we have to overpay to get him to come to Kansas City.
Right. Or do we take that $30 million and go out and get an extra, oh, I don't know, 30 prospects?
Right, absolutely.
And what they did, the Pirates did the same thing.
Yep.
And it doesn't always work out. And there's guys you end up paying. They end up, both of them have guys you look at and you say, they give that guy that much money?
Yeah, exactly.
Zyphon Rosenberg, Tim Melville, things like that. That being said.
Tim Melville, nice. Blast from the past.
But that being said, they both they benefited enormously from that.
No doubt.
And again, I will come back to, I follow that at some point there may have been a need to make a correction because if. The Yankees, the Red Sox had already done it, but if the Yankees had done it and the Angels had done it and the Dodgers had done it, there would be a point where you'd say, no, this is disadvantageous
right.
to the small market teams. That point had not happened, and they took this away.
And the Red Sox spent like that, and they benefited from it last year, but they've also finished last in their division two of the last three seasons. Very strange. And at the same time, though, you look at Boston's farm system and say, this is a team that is really positioned to be very good again with cheap young talent in the near future, but it's very strange that they spent as profligately as any team. The Nationals, another team again that used to stink on toast, and they spent profligately in the draft back to back years with the number one overall pick. I think the year they
not only that, but back to back years, but also and it's become like the thing. It's become part of draft bingo.
Right.
What is the injured guy who is a Scott Boras, you know, client who will fall in the draft?
Lucas Giolito, Eric Fetty. I mean, injured, he only fell six spots, but Anthony Rendon was injured.
Right.
I mean, DH the whole year.
Check.
And it certainly has benefited them. Yeah, my favorite in the National League is definitely Washington. I'm glad you had the digression on Pittsburgh. I don't know who the favorite is in the American League. Even with their injuries, I feel like it's Baltimore because I think their starting pitching is underrated significantly, and I feel like their bullpen is just outstanding. I feel like they have more ways to beat you.
I see. I'll disagree.
Okay.
And the reason I say I don't think so is that I think in the playoffs, could be wrong, this is just kind of one of those gut feel things, their offense.
It's home run oriented.
If they don't get home runs, they don't hit singles. They don't ever get an extra base, ever.
They're cloggers.
I was going to say, I think, you know, basically you could pick out, a stat I did last week is Terrence Gore has played like 8 games for the Royals, and I think he would be third on the Orioles in steals.
Yeah, I think you're right. No, it's a clogging team. And also, I mean, like, Adam Jones had this great year. Adam Jones, I think, has 132 strikeouts and 19 walks. But that said, though, JJ, this is such a less offensive era. I feel like they're going to run, they have too much power. They're going to run into one. I think enough times to win those low-scoring games with their bullpen. And I also like their defense, even without Machado. I think one of the more underrated players of the last 10 years is J.J. Hardy.
J.J. Hardy's the guy who every year you go, oh, so how much longer does he have?
And yeah, you know, I know his home runs were down, but the guy is such a good defensive player. He's so reliable. And, you know, his teams win. When he was with Milwaukee, that's when they got good and went to the playoffs. Did they go to the LCS the year with the shortstop there? Then they traded him to Minnesota because they had Alcides Escobar coming up. And Minnesota, he went to the playoffs there. And now he's gone to Baltimore, and he's won there. If he's Derek Jeter's short-term replacement in New York as a free agent, that's smart if New York goes in that direction. He'd be smarter than Brendan Ryan. I'm basically saying that for the internal Yankees fans here in the office who form a Brendan Ryan fan club that I can't understand.
But I do think, though, I think that they're, I do like their bullpen and all, but I do think that in,
I just know,
in the playoffs, in the playoffs where offense is down, it's funny, like, we just talked about how, in some ways, the Royals are the exact opposite, obviously, of them. I think that the Royals' approach in the playoffs is often a little bit more productive. Maybe that's the reason. I mean, the team that I look at over the last 20 years and go, wait, how did they? And they made it twice, so I shouldn't.
Right.
But how did the Indians, how did the 90s Indians never win one?
Hard to believe.
Chip Kelly batting. Oh, by the way. Okay, the good news is you got to the middle of the lineup, and so now you got Tomei and Manny coming
in. Well, the 21st century Indians, as we were just talking about, I just read someone, a blogger, talking about Ron Gardenhire getting fired and how the Twins won the division four times in 6 years. Yeah, but the American League Central was weak. It's like, I just read that, and I just kind of did a double take. Like, the White Sox won a World Series for the first time in 88 years in that span of weak American League Central. And the Indians had Cliff Lee and CeCe Sabathia at the same time. The Indians just had this ridiculous time shift where they had these two Cy Young Award winners 10 years too late, basically. And they just had one of those dudes when they had those Tomei, Manny Ramirez, just one. You got to feel like LeBron wouldn't have had so much pressure to win one for Northeast Ohio. The Indians would have gotten it done. But my
point being, though, is that
this is the kind of team that could win.
I do think, I wonder how much does, I don't want to go too far in manufacturing because I think that there is a chance that a team like the Royals, because you get the postseason, and we're going to see, it's going to be College World Series in Omaha, type approach, which I do think, no, this is not something where you're bunting, you know, in the first inning to try to, you know, to get a guy from second to third, which Ned Yost did recently.
I'm going to say, you don't know, JJ.
I think you can take yourself out of situations just as easily. That being said, I do think that having a contact-oriented, put-the-ball-in-play type approach.
That is a good approach, I think, in today's baseball. I think that's the other trend that you're going to – that will be the counter to all the bullpen, the relievers, and the shifting and that kind of stuff. Bat control – hitters have a little bit more contact rate and bat control to counter those.
The digression, back to the digression one more time, though, is do you think that we're going to have to, at some point, change the rules of the game? Because, again, I worry, we both talked about it. If we come in a situation where teams go, you know what, on a normal night, we are better off, especially come postseason, we are better off if we get four and just handing it off.
I don't think so. I don't think that's going to happen. I think there are other. I know there's this time of pace of game, pace of play committee that inexplicably has George Will and all these old people on it. I just don't understand why these Commissioner Selig loved his committees. I think they will have other recommendations that don't include limiting the manager's choices of pitchers he can use. So I don't think that I don't think we're going to have to get to that point because changing pitchers in between innings doesn't slow the game down as much. It's the in-inning changes and the visits. That's the stuff that kills it. That might be legislated out, but
what I'm saying is if you do that, I think if that's what I'm talking about, though, is this, if there is some legislation that says, you know what, you can't use, you cannot go righty lefty righty.
I do think that's possible. Yes, I do. I do think that's possible. Against it. I don't like it. I wouldn't want to legislate that, but I would want to see if the game just naturally takes care. Usually those things do evolve. And again, if hitters evolve to less of an all-power sellout approach to more of a contact-oriented approach against this kind of pitching that they're seeing, but you know, or the other change could just be a redefinition of the strike zone. If you just lift the strike zone a little bit and make it top of the knees instead of bottom of the knees for a strike, and you force pitchers to be up, yeah, you're going to have that velocity. But if you miss up, you're more likely to get punished for it as opposed to when you miss down, you miss with a ground ball. You get hurt with a ground ball as opposed to a home run. Those are kind of unforeseen changes. I would not want to monkey with the rules like that if you didn't have to. But
my worry is I do worry that we may. I thought you were saying but we have not yet seen. I know how you say the game does often regulate, trend we have seen in baseball over the last 40 years has been for more relief appearances,
correct,
more changes. We haven't seen any that zig back the other way.
Correct.
And that my concern is that because
I mean, that change to me, JJ, maybe I'm thinking too deep on it. I think it has to start at the amateur level. It has to come with Major League Baseball. Stop outsourcing. It's amateur baseball. And take control of the showcase circuit and pre-draft, those kind of things, workouts, whatever. Set the schedule for when players can play in these events, these kind of tournaments, and try to have them so that you develop starting pitchers as amateurs, not one inning, throw to the radar gun development. That is how I think this evolution has been accelerated.
I agree.
Tony La Russa won, but I think it's also it's reinforced at the amateur level, and
right,
I hate it.
Right, so now we're seeing
colleges too do the same thing.
But colleges do too. I mean, right now what we're seeing is, as we talked about, we did stories about how much, like, you look at this draft class and the number of guys who threw 95 plus was insane.
Right.
Most of those guys, if they can maintain that velocity, they're going to be relievers. And when that hits, if you said, hey, by the way, we've got seven guys in our pen who throw 95 plus, which we're going to see teams who can do that.
Yeah, we're close to that now. The Royals are close to that.
When that happens, again, my worry is because as far as the game being watchable, there is nothing that makes a game more watchable about the balance of, I know there's some interesting about, is he bringing the lefty? It's not that interesting, though, when you go, okay, the manager's out for a visit. Ah, yeah, they're bringing the next one. We'll be back after this five-minute commercial break.
And like Bill James writes, there is no strategy to that. You know, it's like in the national, like it's like how he wrote about how the American League actually does have more strategy with the DH. Because in the National League, there's no strategy. You know, the pitcher's either going to make it out if no one's on base, or he's going to bunt if someone is on base.
Or he's going to be hit for.
That's not strategy. That is just not strategy. That's automatic. There's no thought process. It's rote. It's in the binder. If you want to go make that joke. So there's less strategy because you know in the late innings he's going to go to the lefty. Your left-handed hitter is going to face a left-handed pitcher every time. So there is
one part, though, that I almost disparage. It's like, oh, but you know when they have interleague, it's like, well, he's got to be used to the double switch. This isn't brain science. This is not something where you go, okay, well, we need to do brain surgery today. This is like, okay, wait. So I bet this guy seventh and this guy ninth.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not something where you go, oh, I'm all
and just
floppy
so funny,
flu now.
10, 15 years ago, I was so, whenever the DH debate was brought up, I was like, let's just get rid of it. Offense is too high. You know, the need for the DH has passed. I'm sure I said that on a podcast. The need for the DH has passed. The reason it was brought in was to prop up offense. Now it's like, okay, yeah, go ahead and bring the DH to the National League. I don't care. Every other tradition in baseball has been pretty much shattered, whether it's the numbers that don't matter or interleague play or, you know, expanded playoffs. What's the pitcher? The pitcher batting does not bring enough to the game for me to preserve it. I would rather see hitters hit and pitchers pitch. So and leave the Can-Am League as the last league to let pitchers hit. So, JJ, real quick, I'm not going to make you make a pick. I did want to hit on these quick changes. Okay. The quick reaction to Ron Gardenhire getting fired. Any reaction at all?
It had to happen.
It had to happen.
I mean,
Four years in a row, 90-plus losses.
With these decisions, it's the same thing like with the Braves. Like,
that's the next one. Frank Wren getting fired.
My thing is this. I come back to this. These decisions are not made in a vacuum. How, if you were this year in Minnesota, the thing that saved Ron Gardenhire's job for a year was they had the All-Star game this year.
Yeah.
So you could sell tickets based off, get your, you know, buy a season ticket, get your All-Star game ticket.
Come see Byron Buxton and Miguel Sano in the Futures
right.
game.
Oh, don't. But how do you sell, if you did not make changes there, how do you sell that team in this offseason? Same thing with the Braves.
You mean sell them, like buy tickets, not if you're kind of the pole ad selling the team.
Right, but I'm saying how do you market this team
right.
to build some sort of excitement for
and their
next
attendance
year.
Have been down every year in that ballpark because they never win.
And again, not that changing him is going to all of a sudden, like, people are going to line up with the new manager hire
right.
to run to the gates, you know, like, please give me six.
But if you're not
tickets.
Selling the same old, same old. I will say the Twins' development at the big league level of position players continues to be fairly impressive. Brian Dozier is better than anybody thought he would be. Guy hit 23 home runs this year. Danny Santana had a boffo rookie season. If Major League Baseball had changed its rules and said Jose Abreu and Masahiro Tanaka were not rookie eligible, Danny Santana is probably your American League Rookie of the Year. Guy hit over 300 power and speed. He slugged almost like 480. Played shortstop and center field.
Some good pitchers this year too, though.
They were like Yordano Ventura, very good pitcher. I think he's your other competition. But from a position player standpoint, Danny Santana had a really, really good rookie year.
Right.
In any year, he would be a Rookie of the Year contender.
Not for a year,
his year was that good.
But no, but I was going to say...
Kenneth Vargas, another one. They can't develop pitching. It's been a problem for them for like 6-7 years, going back to the is Nick Blackburn really a prospect era.
And they can't develop pitching.
They kill for Nick Blackburn
and
these days.
They can't develop pitching, and they can't go out and... They're really caught in that nether world in between. It worked out this year with Phil Hughes, but the reality is if you are...
They're like 1-for-3, because Phil Hughes, yes. Ricky Nolasco, no. Kevin Correa, shockingly,
if you're bottom feeding for starting pitchers... That's a very dangerous world to be in.
Correct.
Especially, again, this is the thing to me, is this is where the Ray Searges of the world become so valuable.
Yep.
Is if you have a guy like that, those players, Brent Strom, I think, is, we see him in Houston now. If you are an outstanding pitching coach who can really develop guys like that,
right,
you're worth way, way, way more than you ever get paid.
No, you're exactly right. So, that was not a surprise. Neither was... Frank Wren in Atlanta. To me, the thing that makes the most sense for Atlanta when you listen to Bobby Cox and John Schuerholz talk at that press conference about, and how different was that? Frank Wren, nowhere to be seen. Ghost of Braves past brought in. It was like a 1995 World Series press conference with John Hart, Bobby Cox, and John Schuerholz on that dais in Atlanta. Whereas in Minnesota, it was also like a 1995 press conference. Ron Gardner was a coach at that time. Terry Ryan was a GM. No changes there. But Gardenhire was there at his firing press conference. Frank Wren, nah. I'm surprised the Braves just didn't cut Kyle Wren that day just for the heck of it. I mean, just to make a completely clean break off of Kyle Wren, probably one of their top 10 prospects. That, to me, JJ, is the biggest reason why Frank Wren was let go. Yes, the big league team struggled, but they're just not the Braves anymore. Their farm system is bereft. It's a thin farm system.
It is.
And Tony DeMaceo's way of drafting is pretty different from the way that Paul Snyder and after him Roy Clark. Would not shock me if the Braves, there's all the talk about John Coppolella, their assistant general manager, who we both find very capable. Think of him, I think of him as a future GM. I could see him being their GM in training the way John Hart ended up doing that with John Daniels in Texas. But it wouldn't shock me if part of that was, you got to bring Roy Clark back. Roy Clark, scouting director, through 2009. Roy Clark went to Washington. Now he's national cross-checker with the Dodgers. If you're Roy Clark, you're coming back to Atlanta. You got to be invested with some power, if he comes back. But to me, Roy Clark was the Atlanta Braves scouting department for the first 15 years I was at BA. So it would not shock me if he were brought back. And that's a name I don't see talked about with Braves' future that needs to be talked about. It wouldn't even shock me if he were brought back and made general manager.
But... what I think with the, I think you're right, the farm system is thin, very thin right now. The other thing, though, is I think even more than that, what ended up basically leading to Wren's demise is that the Braves have done a wonderful job. When we talk about bottom feeding, like the inexpensive free agent signing,
yep,
they've done that well. They've made some clever trades, but that all gets washed aside by the tsunami that was the Dan Ugla and the B.J. Upton contracts.
Like, and also, yeah, and before that, Derek Lowe. They had to pay someone to take Derek Lowe, too.
Right. They are a team. It's funny. We have – if you've been around baseball as long as both of us have, we're having to recalibrate because I always have thought of – before their current ownership, the Braves were a big market team.
Right, yeah. We grew up with the Braves in the 90s.
And 90s, they were, even when they were terrible.
In the early 80s, certainly, Ted Turner was a profligate spender, like Alex Trevino.
Bruce
Sutter. $500 million. Yeah, exactly. They spent big money on free agents. You're right.
Nick Osaski.
Yeah, nice call.
Hey, I was growing up in Georgia at the time. I could keep going on this. But nowadays, they are a very financially limited team. And they just cannot survive.
They're Ray's North. I mean, why would they get their new ballpark?
Or Mets South.
They are kind of like that.
And that is, to me, again, digression. But
it shows in that division.
To me,
you have three basically teams that run on a very modest budget, which two of them shouldn't. And then you have the Phillies, who are just a whole bunch of
stupid. When we say two of them shouldn't, to me, the crime of all this is that there is the Braves, at least I somewhat understand, in that the reason they were a big market team was the Superstation,
right,
and they don't have that anymore. I follow that. They've got a terrible TV contract. The Mets, there is no... I'm sorry. They're almost, I know you can't put it in the bylaws, but it should be in the bylaws. If you can't afford to spend money on the team in New York when you're the Mets owner, you have to sell the team.
That's really, at some point, I'm sure we'll do some kind of Bud Selig legacy podcast. That's one of the blacker marks, to be on his legacy to me, is the things that, just the inconsistencies, that we've seen this in all other pro sports, the inconsistencies of what's allowed by commissioners of a sport for one owner to another. I mean, Hal Wilpon is still around as an owner, allowed to own a team that's in one of your big markets and operates like that. Well,
it should
it's the
be.
Mets.
But I'm saying, it should be.
Historically, it never has been.
No, but I'm saying, though, when you talk about fandom and all, whenever they're good, they are a flagship. The same way,
the most popular television show of the last 20 years, non-football category, was Seinfeld. And the star of that show was a giant Mets fan. And even he had to do storylines about the Yankees because the Mets were such an embarrassment. And they remain one. And, I mean, it's sad that they don't spend money. They actually had a positive run differential this year. And still were four games out of 500.
They're saying that they're going to have to, though, probably trade off a pitcher or two to make payroll right for next year.
That's unreal.
And there's a
sexual assault case against the owner. I mean, like, how...
Sexual
that's
harassment.
Harassment. Thank you. How that is still allowed to fester is mind-boggling.
We'll do a Bud Selig legacy, and there are many good things. And maybe it's impossible, but the reality is that if you look at it, one of Bud Selig's biggest problems has been bad owners at times. I mean, like, you look at
the
Dodgers.
Takes one to know one.
You look at the Dodgers, and you say, like, I mean, finally the Dodgers are back in. Dodgers were killed. Were basically their flagship status was gutted for a while because of ownership is vital.
Well, just look at it for several of. I mean, that's really, you can think of three of baseball's biggest markets: the LA and New York, where the Mets he allowed to fester, the Dodgers he turned into a laughingstock, like the Mets, and Houston, where Drayton McClain ran that team on the cheap from a team that's the fourth largest city in America, fifth largest city.
Chicago.
Well, yeah. Oh, well, the Cubs.
No. But also, the reality is that the White Sox would spend money, but the White Sox essentially decided to abstain from the draft
But at the same time, the White Sox won a World Series for the first time in 88 years or whatever it was, and the Cubs in the last decade, probably their most successful decade since the first decade. So I can't fault them on the. I think the last 15 years have actually been good in Chicago baseball by Chicago baseball standards.
Yes.
I think
you got to put it in context. I'll give you that.
But Drayton McClain had a team that went to the World Series in 2005 for the first time, most successful era in Astros history, and then he was just basically allowed to again. He paid less attention to the draft than even Jerry Reinsdorf did, and the Astros were running to the ground. And now we have the situation that they have.
Their fans, we're still waiting to see, like, hey, can Houston fans see Houston on TV? I mean,
that's a unique market because, let's face it, can you even imagine any other market in Texas losing a professional football team? Houston, I'm just saying success, you have to keep winning in that market to be vital, and they lost a lot of fans by being as bad as they were. So I'm guessing that wasn't part of the job description when Jeff Luhnow took over. Now A.J. Hinch as their manager. That seems like a match made in heaven, J.J. The analytics organization with a very analytical, an ex-player who has bona fide. He's been a general manager. He's been a manager. He's been a big league player. That seems a good match.
But not that. I mean, he's been a general manager. He's been a manager.
Farm director.
He's been a farm director. I heard that, it was like, this is... If you were going to say match up the two,
yes.
I can't think of a better combination because I can't see that there is going to be any sort of organizational disconnect, which we clearly saw did exist.
Definitely.
There won't be that. And I also think one other thing with it is that...
If it happens, it'll be a personality clash, not a philosophical clash.
But also with that is, and I think that A.J. Hinch, we'll have to see, haven't asked him this or anything, but... They had a pitching coach who is, in some ways, this is not a situation where really you say, hey, you come in and you put together your stuff. The pitching coach is here.
And
it should be.
I think that AJ Hinch is smart enough to recognize that Brent Strom is a significant asset there.
Right.
When you but look at what happened with a Colin McHugh, look at some of the development of their Dallas Keuchel. Look at the growth some of those guys have made.
But what I'm saying, and I think he will do that. Whereas I think that, again, if you went in a different direction, it very well could be, no, wait, you're saying I can't hire my pitching coach?
No, there was a tough summer in Houston in a lot of ways. I understand as an organization that had 6-7 weeks of very bad publicity, this is a winning move to me.
And I've said it before. I don't think on the podcast, I've said it on Twitter. We are now, they have, I think that 6 or 7 weeks is as bad as it gets.
Yeah.
As long as there's not a ruling that comes out that says, by the way, you know, yes, the grievance has been heard. You don't have your 2 first-round picks. As long as that does not happen.
Yes.
We are now, like, the news, the Astros finished much stronger. They're actually, in the last month and 2 months of the season, they're a competitive team.
Their second half was the best 2-3 months of baseball they've played in 5 years, basically.
They have a new manager, which you get the positive publicity from that. You go into next season where
you got a batting champion in Jose Altuve.
And you have a team that you say basically goes into next year where a winning record is not just a goal, but a legitimate one. And, hey, if you get to a winning record, all of a sudden – you can get to 87, you know, a playoff spot is going into next year with a couple of free agent signings is not an incredible crazy, like you laugh and say, you know, what are they thinking?
Last thing, any thoughts on the changes in Arizona with Dave Stewart becoming a general manager under Tony La Russa, or the least surprising firing of the offseason so far, Marty Wolliver being fired in Philadelphia as their scouting director after a 12-year tenure?
First off, in Arizona, I mean, you had to see things change. I mean, they zigged with, if you're going to do it, you do it. But you look at it in hindsight and you go, okay, I mean, I'll put it this way. No organization out there in the next decade is going to say that when they trade, that really what we're looking for is grit.
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
That has been killed. That has been killed for a long, long time to say that we're, you know, that's why we're making moves.
We are in a world where mistakes keep getting repeated, as we see in the Middle East. But, I don't see that happening.
That's gone.
You do also wonder, like, is Kevin Towers' career as a general manager over? Feels like it probably is. That was a pretty disastrous run in Arizona. I wonder if Kirk Gibson ever gets a chance to manage again. I would imagine so, but
I'm not
probably
going to
take a couple of years.
It's going to take at least, I mean, what he needs to do now is find a cohort or someone who can have him as a bench coach or something where he can have success somewhere.
And also lighten up a little bit.
Right. You know? And what was the second one?
It was Marty Wolliver firing.
There's no other way to put it, you know, but that is one of those things where I'm trying to find a good analogy. I'm not going to find one in 10 seconds on the podcast. So, the boss fires the scouting director, and the rightful question that anyone who gets fired by the Phillies can have right now is, wait, but you're still here?
Scapegoat City, no doubt. I'm not saying that Marty Wolliver was the greatest scouting director of all time. I loved it. At the time, this 2008 draft, that turned out he had like 8-9 big leaguers on that 2008 draft. And I don't think scouting and player development is the biggest reason why the Phillies are in the predicament they're in. They traded a ton of prospects. Hey, Jonathan Singleton is over there. I know he hit 160, but he's still a guy they're building around. That's a guy the Phillies drafted.
We could probably come close to putting together an entire lineup of traded Phillies.
Yeah, guys they scouted and developed. I mean, a homegrown infield would probably have Singleton. Villar was not a drafted guy, but a guy they drafted. Sal Agostinelli, very productive international group. Cody Ashe, who did play third base for them. Obviously, they already have a homegrown middle infield. Although Chase Utley has been there so long, he was drafted by Mike Arbuckle. I do think it's ironic that Arbuckle helping Kansas City get to the big leagues, whereas the Phillies have faltered. Big leagues, the playoffs.
Yeah. It's hard to remember, but Travis d'Arnaud was,
Phillies draft pick 2007. Yeah, great point.
It's hard to remember that because he's a rookie this year with a Mets.
He's traded so many times,
He's been traded so many times, but that was, they traded him.
Even David Buchanan this year kind of came out of nowhere, went through the Rule 5 draft last year, undrafted, and he was solid this year in the big leagues. He was pretty decent for a rookie. I mean, there's something there. The guy was an unsigned 7th-round pick at high school.
But again,
I think Marty Wolliver,
when we talked about repeating mistakes, three seasons ago now, if we just finished the season. So 3 seasons ago, coming off of success, and they struggled, it is completely fair to say let's keep the gang together and right. see if we can get one more out of it.
Yeah, but you're coming off 2012. To go into 2013 and think, let's try one more with one last breath, we'll stab at thee. But then to come back in 2014 with the same cast and crew, that was stunning.
And then in mid-season to say, well, we're kind of shocked to see that, you know, all these guys have gotten hurt and they're not as productive. And you go, your lineup's 35 years old.
And these other general managers weren't bold enough to make a trade.
They weren't bold enough to take my problems, you know, my contract problems. Again,
it's a pretty big disaster for a franchise that 4 years ago seemed like a model franchise because they had it all rolling. And Ruben Amaro has taken that and run it into the ground in quick fashion. It didn't take long. He seemed to be the only one who didn't. He was the last one to figure it out. So,
and then
Amari Woolover got scapegoated, I think. Certainly the Ben Wetzler thing did not help JJ. I think he deserves some of the ridicule for taking a situation like that. And I'm not defending the kid. The kid probably lied. The kid said he was going to sign and then change his mind. But 21, 22-year-old guys, they do that. You just don't to be the one organization that outed a player like that and turned him into players, not a good look. And I think that, as much as anything, is why he was easy to scapegoat for Ruben Amaro.
The interesting one last thing, this is a separate podcast of his own to be done at some point. The interesting thing about the current CBA structure and how it structures financially, in some ways, it almost creates a system that makes it very difficult for big market teams. I don't think it is completely an accident that we saw the Yankees have struggled for multiple years now.
Yeah.
The Red Sox won it. I mean,
yeah,
basement
the Phillies.
Won it. Basement the Phillies
and the Angels are headed there.
And the Angels, I mean, we're right now, if you're looking at the 2016-2017 Angels, you say, ooh, this...
And hey, guess who picks last in the first round in 2015 right now, as of now? The Angels.
Right. All that because the way that it's been structured, you've taken the money out of talent acquisition, player acquisition. You are fixed, essentially, in how much you can spend in the draft.
Yeah.
Not even essentially. You are fixed.
You're fixed.
You are fixed in how much you can spend.
Internationally, too.
Essentially. Now, you can go out like the Yankees did this year every other year and spend money.
Right.
But you are, and the thing about this is, I bet you that we're going to see that get closed.
Yeah. But for 2016, though, just for grits and chiggles, for 2016, the only way the Angels are going to avoid this tunnel, the light at the end of the tunnel has gone out, the only way they're going to relight that on their helmet looking ahead is Japan or Cuba. If I were the Angels, if I were Jerry DePoto, well, that's why you're just kicking the can down the road
right.
with that. If I were Jerry DePoto, I'd be scouring Ben Badler's top 10 Cuba list and saying, how can we get some of these pitchers out of here?
But my thing being, though, that so what that has is when you take all that money away, you got to spend the money somewhere.
So, this has to be the last point.
So it ends up being free agency. Well, what happens in free agency? You end up getting guys to contracts that you go, that's going to really... Carlos Beltran's contract, I mean, which is not even the biggest deal that the Yankees have done. How many deals have the Yankees done in the last decade that 2, 3, 4 years... CeCe Sabathia's deal, which was great at the start,
It
looks awful now.
Hey, Teixeira, they're still paying A-Rod and have to deal with A-Rod next year. So there are a lot of those for those larger market teams. I agree. Basically, the rules in Major League Baseball has set up an NFL-style churn where... And it really makes you wonder if you're a fan of the 277 expansion teams that in the last, since 2003, 28 of the 30 teams have been to the postseason with the Mariners and the Blue Jays, the only exceptions. Their turn has to be coming up soon because that's the way baseball's rules are certainly set up and reinforced. That definitely is a part of Bud Selig's legacy he's probably most proud of. And in his mind, he's enhanced competitive balance probably more than any commissioner ever
there
had.
Is
and
no,
there's some truth to that.
There is truth to that because there is no team now that you say, if you have a well-run front office
they can't
over
win.
A five-year span, you may be bad.
The Royals proved it.
but you may be bad. You will get good because, again, the one thing about it is the structure now is we just talked about it. Now that we have the order, again, short of the Astros being told, nope, those two first-round picks, they're not yours anymore.
Right.
Short of that, they should dominate next year's draft in a way we've never seen.
They have the wherewithal, and the teams that pick 3 and 4 are almost in real trouble because the Astros at 2 and 5 can dictate terms.
Right, not legally, but they can though because they pick 2.
Right.
So when they're talking, you know, it's a very small window, but you could legally, when you're on the clock, be like, hey, what about this? And then go,
I believe it's Colorado and Texas that pick in those two spots, and that's not going to be a fun place to pick. No. So they're going to hone in on their players. They're going to have a list of 3 and 4 guys and be ready to go with those guys. And that list probably actually going to have to be deeper than that, people who will sign for what they can pay. I got other stuff to do. So does JJ. Great podcast, JJ. That was fun. Fun, long, big league podcast. Reminder, baseballamerica.com/stores, where you can load up on your Baseball America 2015 books from the directory, which comes out in January, the Almanac, Prospect Handbook, the Super Register, and all of our other products, the Hall of Fame Almanac as well.
One other pitch I want to put in there is also you can go to baseballamerica.store. If you're not a subscriber right now, perfect time to subscribe. We're putting up the league top 20s right now. You know, chats for the subscribers.
You want bang for your buck, prospect lists, subscriber-only chats. This is a great time.
Not just prospect lists, but full scouting reports. So we're going to basically put scouting reports up on,
Well, there's 320, I think, reports of 20 times 16 leagues. So, yeah, 320, is that right?
Plus indie ball coming.
So. I'm not counting that. Plus all the Cupid stuff. And then plus, of course, 300 scouting reports coming with your top 10s this offseason. And the prospect handbook with 900 scouting reports plus whatever Cuban and Japanese and Korean posted players we squeeze into the appendix. So for JJ, I'm John. We'll see you in the next Baseball America podcast. So long, everybody.